You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
This is Marcus Welch, and you're listening to Rebel Radio. Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
What did you say, Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio. What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine. This week, I bring you a great interview with Marcus Welch. He's the co-founder of Quadio, which started as a music streaming platform for college students and quickly evolved into a community to facilitate collaboration, discovery, really a whole support system for all types of creators on college campuses. Marcus has some great stories about his journey as a DJ and working at tech companies into co-founding Quadio and how he's learned to lead his people and the broader community. There's some great lessons, some great stories. I hope you dig it. Let's get into it.
Nice, man. Well, I'm excited to connect with you. I just learned about what you're doing recently and it seems really cool.
Thanks.
So is it Quadio?
Yeah, Quadio.
Okay, exactly. Cool. Right on. Yeah, I figured. But yeah, it looks amazing. So I want to learn all about it and about you and how you got to this and whatever else you want to talk about.
I really appreciate you having me on to talk to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll get into a bunch of details, but tell me about let's talk about you first and how this all started for you. First of all, do you remember the first record you ever bought for yourself?
Yeah, I do actually. I went to Newbury Comics in Boston. I was living in Boston at the time, and I went and I picked up Demon Days by Gorillaz. That was my first like CD I purchased for myself. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I was really into it. My old babysitter had gifted me, I guess, a bunch of CDs, and I think their self-titled one was one of them. Mm-hmm. I was really pumped to hear more from them. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Gorillaz was groundbreaking, and I think for their visuals, like they were kind of early on what the way the world would start moving in terms of just really taking the visual storytelling really seriously.
Yeah, they're all like kind of weirdos, which I liked. I liked that a lot. Trying to think about like why that was the first one specifically, because I listened to a lot of stuff back then. I think like it was mostly like what CDs we had around the house. Mm-hmm. My mom listened to like a lot of Hole, and then I had like a whole collection of CDs that my babysitter had given me. So I think I had like an Offspring compilation and like Illmatic and that Gorillaz CD. And I think like, I do think what you said about the visuals though is really important. It's something I've been like obsessed with forever, is just, you know, the visual details of anything, how it looks and the vibe it gives off. I think that album cover's great, obviously, you know, heavily inspired, but that one stuck out to me for sure. Yeah.
Nice. And then you started DJing pretty young, right?
Yeah.
Who put you on the decks? How'd that happen?
I was more of a radio DJ than anything. Started in high school. Cause I was obsessed with music, all through like middle school and I tried playing instruments, but I wasn't very good at it. Mm-hmm. I was just not coordinated enough. But I was just like always listening to stuff. And so when I got to high school, I was looking for an activity, I guess, to do. It was a boarding high school. And I didn't know anybody. I didn't have like a lot of hobbies outside of listening to music. And so that was something, joining the radio station was something that I could do that I was really hyped about.
Nice.
So yeah,
do you remember your first
freshman year?
Do you remember your first radio show?
Yeah, it's it started out as it was an hour every week, and I started out as like I alternated between like classic hits and new experimental like weird stuff that I liked, that I was digging. So like, some like indie band I had heard of, like scouring through blogs, and then like the Bob Dylan song or something like mm-hmm. that. Just like alternating.
I see, your bio describes you as an experimental music DJ. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting classification, right? Because I wonder, like, how do you draw that line in your mind about what classifies as experimental and or what draws you to a particular record?
Yeah. For me, I think like there's like definitely artists who would define themselves as experimental, but I think that my definition of it is a little bit broader than that. Like a little bigger tent. And I think that when I was in college, I had like a radio show, and then I had two radio shows on as well. And they had recently launched like an online one, so I could play explicit stuff. It wasn't like FCC mm-hmm. monitored. Mm-hmm. So that's why I got to like really do more of the experimental stuff. And there it was just like artists and or bands or projects that I felt were taking a genre and trying to move it forward or trying to do something different with it, as opposed to what was working necessarily or what like was a guaranteed success mm-hmm. or at least the people would vibrate with. So mm-hmm. yeah, I think that I did that for hip-hop. I had like a hip-hop show specifically about that, and then I had one that was more like singer-songwriter or electronic stuff sometimes found its way in there as well.
So what's like an experimental hip hop record that comes to mind?
My favorite artist in hip hop, I would say, is someone more experimental, or I guess he goes by Rap Ferreira now, or Rory. Milo is what he went at for a lot of years.
Twisted world where artists bend backwards for benefactors, and victims are to be blamed as bad actors. My mind running all around. Poetry is illegal unless you're under the underground.
And I think that's something that I like what he's doing, in that it's really like poetry at its core. He really takes hip hop back to its roots of like being spoken word poetry, being, beat poetry, and mm-hmm. taking a lot of his lyrical inspiration and content inspiration from what was being discussed and talked about and put into poetry back at the origin, but also, self-produces, makes a lot of like weird off the wall beats, a lot of off the wall references to like obscure nerdy stuff that I like a lot.
Cool.
So I think that he's, referencing the origins and trying to do something different. I mean, I think like his albums always feel like the only person making music like this is him. So mm-hmm. I think that qualifies for me as well, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. I think, most of the conversations around, music, and certainly the music business, right, is about, it's about hits. It's about artists trying to make a living or massive amounts of money, on their craft. And obviously that stuff's all important. And, but also, there's those artists who are not doing that, right? Who are exploring boundaries and trying to, challenge themselves or their listeners or whatever. And I think that stuff is also really important and sometimes overlooked, right? And that, you 100%. Forget that those records then often inspire other artists to do things and that push the art form forward.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's all about how you define, you know, success as an artist, right? If you're, if I think for Rap Ferrer or Rory, you know, success for him is being able to feed himself and his kid and keep putting out music and inspire another generation of musicians in his footsteps. And I think that that's really cool. I think that, you know, people like Nicholas Jaar, who I'm sure make money off of their music for sure, but it feels like success there is being able to express their own feelings and emotions through their music. And people seem to really love it. I really love it. You know, I think like, I'm not against any artist making a ton of money off of their music. That's not to say that like, that's something I don't like. I think that that's awesome. A lot of my favorite artists are, you know, pop stars and massive, like, you know, industry icons. But I also love when someone whose definition of being a successful musician is, you know, properly expressing themselves and meeting their goals.
Yeah. How much do you see that? And I want to jump into kind of what you're doing with Quadio, but how much do you see that in, you know, the up and coming musicians that you're working with now? Like, is there, you know, how much do you see artists who aren't focused on becoming the next Travis Scott or Lady Gaga or, you know, the, or whatever their lane is, right, on being that next superstar?
Yeah, I mean, we talk to and see and meet a lot of artists, tons, you know, thousands of young artists looking to be an artist professionally. And I would say like the vast majority are ones who want to be huge, but that's not to say that that's all we see. I think that that's what you're, I think, you know, an artist who is just starting out, whose goal it is to really like be a pop star, is going to be someone who's more apparent to people who are engaging that community as well. Because if you're a developing artist and your goal is to make weird stuff and like push boundaries, you're not also the person who's like DMing everybody to get written about or you know, putting yourself out there, really trying to grow your Instagram numbers, doing marketing. Like, you know, I think that those are the people who we see a lot more of, the folks doing experimental stuff in our communities. Like, we have our Discord or, you know, our Instagram comments or the clubs that we run there. They show up there and they engage and they're like amazing members of our community, but they're not the people who are like, please like write about me for your blog or like, please, you know, do a 10 and 10 with me or anything like that. I think, and we have done some of them because we want to showcase all creativity and we want to, you know, champion these creatives and get their voice out there. But, you know, I think the ones that are like, this needs to be my career, I want to like be the next Drake, like, are going to be the people who are like, we're going to see more of that, I think.
Right.
It's really,
yeah, of course.
It's attractive.
Of course. Yeah. So you'd started down the kind of corporate route. I know you worked at Twitter and at Blizzard. Take me back to the decision to leave Blizzard and start this business.
Yeah. It was an interesting time. I really liked working at Blizzard. I thought that I had like such an awesome team. The folks I was working with there, I still talk to them and they're great people, but I obviously had been working in music all throughout college and high school. And then right after college, music at Twitter. And when I was at Blizzard, obviously I was working in gaming and in marketing. And I'm also like a lifelong gamer and I love playing games. I love playing Blizzard games. And so Blizzard had been a company that like I'd always had my eye on, but as soon as I left music, I like felt this pull like back to it for sure. I think that I'm, you know, a lot of people who work in music feel like it's the only option. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I missed music. I missed the East Coast as well and New York. I think that LA is an awesome place, but it's not my place. I think that it was just like a different speed of things, or just, I don't know, I miss the seasons. So
is that right?
I had really been like longing to get back into it. And then my step cousin, our relationship's a little weird. It's like technically I think my step nephew, but we're 2 years apart. So step cousin. So had just graduated from college, and he came to me with the idea, the sort of the initial idea for Quadio, which in his words was like a streaming platform for college students. And I thought, like, you know, having done college radio and understood the power of a local community rallying around musicians within their community, showing up to their music, like, the importance that that has for the development of like a young artist's career, I thought it was a really cool idea. And then we sort of fleshed that out as a concept for a couple of months and eventually thought about, okay, it's, you know, it's a platform that does more than just, you know, show you who's making music in your circles or in your college. You know, it can do all these different things. It can be a home for creatives to, you know, find their crew, to share their work, to gain recognition amongst their peers. And so we had mapped out this whole, you know, structure of things. And at that point, like, it, the more we time we put into it and the more energy we put into like mapping out what this could be, the more it was like, I have to do this. Like, I love, you know, I actually learned a ton at Blizzard. Like, I went in as, I mean, at Twitter, I had been doing music partnerships and I learned a lot there. I learned a lot about, you know, how musicians and artists talk to their fans and how that information is received. And then at Blizzard, I learned a lot about how a business talks to their consumers and how those messages are received. And trying to understand the average, you know, game player, music listener, and what they receive from the people that they are, you know, consuming content from. That was really important in terms of like how we crafted Quadio's brand, and our messaging and our voice. But I was really dying to like get back into music, and I love working with Joe. I think he's a great guy, and I love the idea. And the more we worked on it, the more it became our idea. And it just became an inevitability at a certain point. So yeah, we jumped ship and we both quit our jobs in October 2018, and then started building it in our living room. Yeah,
cool. So yeah, I definitely appreciate that call, that, you know, being called, you know, to music and to kind of develop this vision and then go bring it to life. I think it's also scary for a lot of people to step away from a full-time job and security and, you know, what was that like? You know, what fears did you find yourself confronting, and what'd you do to address those?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of fears. I think like anytime you start something new, there's a ton of fears, even if it's a full-time gig. And you don't have to have the fear of like, where am I getting money to pay rent? There's lots of fears about like, what do my coworkers think about me? Or like, you know, how am I going to move up in this company? Or how am I going to be remembered when I make the next move or anything like that? Sure. I think like, I was used to having fears in any job that I was in, because both Twitter and Blizzard were enormous companies with huge reputations. And I was a really junior kid at both of them, and I wanted to like be making a difference. And I was always worried, like, does anyone know that I even do anything here? Like, you know? And so I think starting your own company, it's a very opposite side of that. But I think like, to answer your question directly, I think that I was really worried about like, I think sort of what I was saying before, how do we as a brand position ourselves for this demographic of these college musicians? I think like in a way that is going to be well received, because I've seen so many brands, you know, established and new, try and reach musicians and be seen as like fake or inauthentic and just immediately tossed out, even if the idea was really good. The approach was incorrect, and it didn't matter how much time, effort, or money was put into things. I think, like, no, like, offense, but like looking at like places like Quibi or something like that, like, sure, the idea might have been awesome, but like, it almost didn't matter. Like, people got, I think, like, it just, you know, it faded away really quickly. And so we looked at a lot of that, and it was like, okay, this means our visuals and our voice and what we're offering have to be really authentic. And that inspired a lot of how we started getting our name out there at all. Meaning like we didn't do marketing. We drove around from campus to campus and met with artists and showed them wireframes and talked to them about what we were doing and got feedback from them, because we knew that like, if this is going to be a successful platform for creatives, who are incredibly technically savvy and very particular and very creative, it needs to be what they actually like really want. So like, let's get information from them about how they'd want to see this mission that we have executed in reality. So I think the fears were, are we doing this right? Is our sample size big enough? Are the ideas that we have for this platform that we're hearing this positive feedback on going to work in reality when we actually give it to people?
I mean, that's interesting. I love that you point out that, you know, there's, there's fear, there's risk, there's a cost to no matter what you do. Right. And I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs. I talk to a lot of corporate folks who, you know, think they want to be entrepreneurs and step out on their own. And like, I'm always like, you know, it's not, one's not better than the other, right? Like it's like, what fear would you rather confront on a daily basis, right? Is this one or this one? And then depending on that should lead you, you know, down the path.
If work's going to have its like scary elements, I'd rather be in control of my own destiny than,
But you know, look at, you know, you saw the announcement yesterday with Apple, their new, tags product. Right. And so imagine working at Tile right now, imagine being the CEO of Tile today and have it right. Come in.
That was definitely a fear as well. It's like, you know, we're trying to build a social streaming platform. It's like, okay, tomorrow Spotify could announce that they're adding social features back to Spotify. I mean, they got rid of a lot of them a long time ago, but like, they could bring back all this stuff. And, you know, what, in that case, what are our unique differentiators still? What are we still bringing to this audience that they wouldn't get in that situation? And I think a lot of that is the brand, and the relationship we have with our users, but also on a technical level, there has to be stuff as well. And so that was a big focus too.
So you went out and talked to all these college students. Give me a couple of the insights. I mean, I know you were getting feedback on wireframes and some of that stuff, right? Tactically, but what were some of the big insights that stood out from those conversations?
I did it for a little while, and then Joe then took a team of people and did it for another like 6 months. We talked to, I think, like something like 5,000 artists across the country and using Joe's mom's car, and they were just sort of ripping around the country and Airbnb-ing in different college towns. It was awesome, and we learned a lot. I would say, I think one of the big things that we learned is like that there is just this immense like lack of visibility into who in your community is like also being creative. We would talk to, you know, 30 artists on a campus, and every one of them would say like, I feel like I'm the only musician on campus, or I feel like I'm the only, like, you know, me and my boy are like the only people making music, like hip hop on our campus. Sure. And we'd have just talked to like six other people who said the same thing. And I think like, cool, there's so much creativity on every college campus. That was another sort of learning, is like, you know, we had all these estimates going in about how many people on any given college campus were like actively making music. And I think like it was, there were so many more people than we thought. I think like, you know, you can look at the size of the music school or something like that, but that's, you know, a tiny fraction of who's actually making music, because a lot of people are like Joe, an econ major, and they make music in their free time because they love it. The barrier to being a creative is a lot lower because the tools are more accessible.
Sure.
And so a lot more people make music, a lot more people dabble in music and, you know, have it as a hobby. But I think one of the sort of initial things that got Joe thinking about the idea was that he was a senior in this like songwriting class at a pretty small campus, Williams, with like 20 other songwriters. And he had been in classes with them his entire 4 years in college and didn't know that a single one of them made music. And was like, man, we could have been working together on music for 4 years. And I didn't know that you did it. And I think like we found that that was happening on like every campus we touched down at, from places like, you know, even like Berkeley and Belmont to, you know, enormous campuses like USC and stuff like that. So that was pretty remarkable. And I think that it really reinforced that was something core that needed to like exist within the Quadio platform, was visibility into who around you is a creative, what they do, what they're looking for, and giving you the ability to reach out to them and connect with them on that.
Yeah, I think that's huge. I think, you know, for to some extent, just the feeling that you're not alone, right, is big. Okay. I know, you know, all my friends who are creative people, which is most of them, you know, there's definitely a loneliness there, or just a I don't even know if loneliness is the right word, but you're kind of like in it alone.
Yeah.
Right. And you don't always have to be.
For sure.
And I think, you know, even some of the stuff we were talking about earlier with like the visuals and the other pieces of what it takes to make music or make a music career, that, you know, there's resources out there.
Definitely.
That people aren't always aware of.
Yeah. And a lot of those times those resources, you know, yeah, there's like YouTube and like online classes and stuff. A lot of them are like just your peers.
Sure.
And that's something we're trying to do with Quadio now, is it started as just music and like, let's just do that. But it's evolving to encompass all creative fields. And so, you know, as a musician, Quadio should be a place where you can find your friend who's going to, you know, make your album art or shoot your first music video. And
absolutely.
As a sculptor, you should be able to find the person who's going to, you know, make the ambient soundtrack to your first like gallery opening, you know, like,
yeah,
I want great. It to be the home for all of that.
Nice. You talked a little bit about stuff you learned, from Blizzard and Twitter. What did you set out to do differently when you started your own company?
That's a great question. I'll say one thing I tried to set up to do the same, just to start, was at both companies, I had awesome managers. I had small, but like just incredible teams. And I wanted to have that same relationship with the people who worked at Quadio. I wanted it to be something where like we were learning from each other and teaching each other all the time, but that we could also like just be great friends outside of work. So that was really important as we brought folks on, was like that it wasn't just a professional relationship. But in terms of different, I mean, there's so much that's different between a you know, a 15 person startup and an enormous entity like Blizzard. So I think that one thing that was tough about both places, and I think that this is just the nature of any enormous company, is just like inter-team politics and needing to present information or ideas or new ideas specifically in a certain way to have them like heard,
right,
or seen by upper management or anybody really. And I think that like in a large organization, an enormous organization, that's a necessity in some capacity, just because of the way that the machine works. Like, you know, having an assistant, like, you know, project manager, which is what I was, like trying to pitch an idea about how this one of our, you know, six gigantic IPs could be doing, you know, X, Y, or Z thing differently. There's channels you got to go through to get that heard. But I think that like, what I wanted for us was that we met regularly as a team. Anybody could chime in and say anything. You know, our graphic designer could have an idea about the way that the social feed and the platform works, and that should be like a voice that's heard. And you know, that advice taken. So nice. I think like it's a luxury we have as a small team, but also it's something that, like, as we grow, I hope to continue that culture of, like, all folks, like, actually, because I think, if I'm remembering correctly, both Blizzard and Twitter had one of their values as a company along the lines of, like, every voice matters. And it does within your team, but there was, like, really strict rule sets about how to get it to matter, or at least how to get it to be heard. And I think that, like, I'd love to have those channels flow a little bit more openly. Like, I'd love for anyone to be able to drop me a line or, you know, just put time on my calendar and talk.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, obviously that's one of the challenges of scale, and there's a, you know, politics is embedded in our human nature, right? And we have to, like, actively work to combat or you know, limit certain forces, right? The effects they can have. And I think that's one of the, just the challenges of leadership. I think it's interesting. I don't know if you, I'm curious if this came up for you, but it, you know, it's interesting to go from, you know, an environment where you have to work and do certain things right to get your ideas heard to one where everything you say is going to be heard by everyone and taken, you know, with a certain, you know, it's going to be taken a certain way just by the nature of your title. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if that was there a transition in your thinking around that?
Yeah, definitely. I think it was an adjustment to having everything I was saying be taken, like, very seriously. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, at Blizzard, where I had gone from being basically a project manager, to then by the time I left, I was doing, like, marketing strategy for some of our games. And so, like, I had gotten used to, like, things I was suggesting or saying being taken more seriously than when I started. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I wasn't, like, in charge of anything, really. I was a contributor on a team that was making big decisions, but I wasn't, like, what I'm saying now is sort of the end all be all. But that's also not how I try, and I don't, like, wield the CEO sword and mm-hmm. sort of come down and say, okay, my word is totally final. I think that's one thing about, like, a lot of our decision making when we were in the office and now is very collaborative. And it's very rare that I come in and I'm like, okay, here's the plan we're executing on this specifically. It's like, I come in to say, okay, I've done my thinking and here's the sort of channels I want us to execute on. But now let's talk about all the different mechanisms we can use or the different methods we could use to execute within that channel. And let's come out of this with a collaborative decision that we all agree on that this is the right way forward to, like, you know, and it can be a decision from, like, okay, we want to change one of our brand colors or something like that to what's the next, you know, topic of our next club or, you know,
it's
small decisions, big decisions. They're all very collaborative. At least amongst the sort of leaders on those teams. And then the leaders on those teams engage each member of their team as well. Mm-hmm. So they come to those meetings with their team's opinions as opposed to just their own.
Yeah. So you talked about fleshing out that original vision with mm-hmm. Joe. So you're, what, 3 years in now?
Yeah.
How is that vision, like, where are you relative to that vision, and how has the vision evolved?
Yeah. I would say the initial, like, mission has remained consistent, the North Star of mm-hmm. wanting to build a better platform for college creatives to, you know, harness the knowledge and skill sets of their peers and, like, engage better in their community. That's always been the goal there. Mm-hmm. But, like, at the gates, you know, the vision was to have a platform that was 50% music streaming platform with, like, charts and stuff like that, and 50% like the networking aspect of it. And I think in launching a beta, we learned that the ratio there should be way different. And so how that platform comes to life has changed a lot. And so right now we've shut down the beta as we sort of rebuild a lot of the parts of it. So the initial sort of, like, you know, we had planned out wireframes, like, 2 years into the future. And I think, like,
wow,
that was probably not the best use of our time right out the gate, because you know, as we learned quickly, even just in talking to artists, it was like, we want to build what they want. And so this has all been a lesson in that, is like, let's go back a bit to the drawing board in terms of like what functionalities are going to be front and center. So planning on relaunching the beta this year with a lot more like functionality that is inspired by the learnings of the first one. But I think also, to your question, the initial vision for Quadio was strictly an app. Like, it was a platform. Mm-hmm. And we've grown way beyond that a lot more quickly than we anticipated. We were like, man, it would be sick to eventually have this record label that was attached to it. But that was like 5-year plan. And now we have a record label and we have 6 artists. And we're going to have a live events business. And we were about to launch that and the pandemic hit. So now we have a digital events business like clubs and speaking events and stuff like that. So, and our Discord is like really active. And so like, I think the scope of what we do is a lot bigger than we expected it to be at this point in time. We expected to like be this app and you know, that was going to be that. And now it's like the app is the only thing that right now is not something that was like actively happening for our community. Right. It's being built, but all this other stuff that we're doing is now Quadio.
That's cool. Sounds like, I mean, you get a lot of feedback. You have input from your community.
Yeah.
Teach me how to do that. Right. Like when do you get feedback that's not helpful or that's not, you know, that's like things that are contradictory. You know, when you go out and talk to students, how much do people tend to agree and sort of tell you the same thing over and over versus like these wildly different perspectives, and how do you process all that internally?
Yeah, I would say we hear a lot of different people say a lot of the same things. Mm-hmm. So when we hear something different or contradictory or exciting or like new, it's pretty obvious because it's something that is not like a repeated refrain, which is helpful. It's one of the benefits of talking to like 5,000 people is when someone says something for the first time, it's pretty noticeable.
Sure.
So I think one of our, you know, where we get a lot of data before we start analyzing it as well, which helps us not like make quick decisions that are informed on, you know, one opinion or two opinions or 5 opinions. We try and get talk to a lot of our community members. And I think that like we've done ways to engage with our audience in a lot of there's a lot of different ways we've done it, I guess is what I'm trying to say. From surveys to structured user interviews using methods from our UI UX team, or we've done just like open form communication or just like conversations with, you know, 5 of our most engaged members of our community, people who have been to every single club. Just asking them for their feedback on how we've done our clubs and how we're running our Discord and, you know, what they want to see with a specific functionality. And so I think it's just like actively engaging with them and listening to them, taking all that data and then analyzing it after we've heard from a bunch of people and seeing, okay, here's the common threads. But it's not just like we look at that data blindly and say, okay, you know, 75% of our users want this, we're going to build this. It's like 75% of our users want this. Let's talk about why that is or isn't a good idea. Based on the data that we've gotten from running the app, our industry knowledge, what we've tried and what's worked and what's failed in the past. And so it's just like collecting a lot of data and analyzing it like intelligently as opposed to like blindly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you said a couple of things that I wish more companies would do, which is one is to get a large amount of data, which I think, especially, you know, I think it's easier to do that with, you know, digital first companies. Right. But traditional brands, you know, tend to not probably gather enough information. And then secondly, I love that you're gathering it in different ways, right? Like I think you know, I've worked with a lot of companies that, you know, they do focus groups or they might do surveys, but they don't do all of the things, right? And yeah. And I think there's value in all those different channels bringing you information.
And I think that it's tough, right? Like doing extensive and proper user research is expensive and it takes a lot of time. But I think that we've been able to get around some of those barriers because of the fact that all of our users have come from these personal meetings where we sat down, we met with them, we got their phone number, and then we've continued. It wasn't just like a one-time thing. We continue to check in with them. We, you know, remember when their next EP was dropping and we check in and we listen to it and we tell them it's great. And like, and so it's not so like, okay, we want to test this new functionality. Let's, you know, pay $15,000 and do some crazy research study. It's like,
right.
You know, Joe, can you and your team like reach out to the 50 people who we know are operating in this space and would love this feature, would hate this feature, and just like set up time in the next 2 weeks to talk to them. And then let's like meet back and talk about what you heard from them. So it's almost, you know, with the exception of like our employees, like time, it's like free for us. And that's come from starting and maintaining like real relationships with our audience.
That's big.
That's this big part of our work. And a lot of Joe's team's work, the community team is like the maintaining of these relationships with our community, because it pays off in a million different ways. So research is one of them.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting that you're focused on the college market, right? Like when I was, you know, when I was in college and started my career, like college radio was hugely important, you know, in hip hop, you know, it was where a lot of records started, and, you know, it was a whole genre of college rock. That seems to have kind of fallen away.
It's
fallen away in a big way. Right. And so, you know, I'm curious now, what do you think the music industry can learn from college students and the college market?
That's a great question. A lot, honestly. Like these are the kids who are going to, one, they're going to be the next generation of pop stars. And they're going to be the next generation of like hip hop, you know, artists. And so I think like you see it with the bands that are sort of coming up right now, and like, you know, Brockhamptons or like Junior Varsity or stuff like that, like these kids who just like fully are the culture. Like, I think that a lot of times, it's easy to want to be prescriptive about what's going to work as opposed to like receptive to what is working and then like operating in that channel, and being more like reactive a little bit there. College students are, you know, there are, like we talked about at the beginning, the ones who want to be the pop stars, but there's also the ones that like want to do stuff different. They have really unique perspectives and ideas and visions and voices, and their art is their way of expressing that. And so, I think like a lot of people don't get down into the super trenches and like listen to everything and respect it, as if it was like a Taylor Swift record. Like, I think a lot of it's taken with a super big grain of salt, or like just seen as like, you know, it's just a college student making music, but that's not the case. Like, everyone who's massive now was making music the same time these kids are making music now. And they're all going to be the next big. So I think it's like, I guess the lesson I would say is like, take it seriously, right? Like, there's a reason why college radio like was a huge tastemaker back in the day. And I think all the reason that like college radio isn't anymore is because radio isn't really anymore in a lot of ways. And that role has been taken over by blogs and influencers and, you know, now like TikTok people and stuff like that. But that's not to say that the people making music in college aren't still going to be defining the sound of the next generation or like the next big musical movement. They still are, but the methods of like hearing that and talking about it and getting on those trends before it's too late, like have changed. And again, it's just like the value of like being in an active, engaged conversation with our audience and listening to them is that we're going to hear that first.
Yeah. So when you guys, you know, you talk to all these college students, What are you hearing that's most comforting and most concerning from these next generations?
I think the most comforting thing is just like how many people are making music. I think like for me, it's like quite disheartening. In a way, it felt like for a while, the number of like successful musicians at any given time was like shrinking to a number where it was like, okay, only like the top, you know, 20 artists on the charts are like people who can actively do this as a career. I think like that with streaming, in a way that's changing, with different methods of monetizing your art, like Twitch, or like, you know, partnership deals as a micro influencer, like that's still like a sustainable, you know, business for all these people. So I think the number of artists who are young and unsigned, or, you know, signed to a tiny label, or just like working with their friend as a manager, a lot more of people can have a career as an artist nowadays. So I think that that's really relieving to hear. I think that that's really important for art and for culture. I don't know. I don't think there's a, like, I don't have a ton. There's nothing that like keeps me up at night about like the future of music. It's all quite exciting. Yeah. I think like, I get really pumped about all the different stuff that's happening. I don't feel like, I think like, you know, you could be worried about genres and styles sort of being homogenized, but I don't necessarily feel like that's the case, because I've listened to a lot of the, like, again, I listen to a lot of the experimental stuff, and I know there's enough of it out there, and I see genres and subgenres splitting off into sub-subgenres, and there still being audiences for all that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. So let's talk about the label. I know you said it, you kind of started this label ahead of schedule. Mm-hmm. Tell me about, you know, first of all, how does the dynamic change now that you become, you know, a label, a vehicle for launching these careers, not just a resource in a community? Has that shifted things internally or externally in terms of your relationship with the community?
I don't think it's made like a massive change. I don't know if like, you know, our community saw us as one thing and now they see us as a different thing because we started a label.
Okay. Yeah.
It was really like a way for us, in a way, to put our money where our mouth was and say like, okay, you know, we're this platform for championing college creativity. We want all these artists to see success and to be able to have the option to have music as their career. But we could also be the next step for a lot of these artists too. And like actually be the people who are enabling that for them. And I also know, like, you know, we are a small startup and I don't think our community expects us to be able to sign 100 artists or, you know, anything like that. So we have limited capacity, both in terms of manpower and dollars. But that's not to say like we don't plan on signing more artists. You know, we absolutely do, but it's about doing it at the right time. And also, like, we're not trying to shove our artists down our community's throats either. Like, it's something we're very careful about, say with like our Instagram, right? Like, I think it would have been really easy for us to go from this Instagram account that was showcasing all these diverse, incredible musicians who are making all kinds of music, to exclusively posting about the six artists that we have signed. But I think that would have been totally like the wrong move. And like, we still do use our Instagram, but strategically, and when it feels right, and when it doesn't feel like we're being overwhelmingly talking about any one of our artists, you know, when they have key beats, when they have a single come out, you know, we'll want to represent it. But it's just the sort of the same as we would have with like another artist. It's like, we think this music is awesome. We think this young creative is doing incredible stuff. And we think this song is something you should hear. And here's why, and let's boast about it in that capacity. And so I think that, you know, we definitely have a lot of our community who's like, can you sign me, or, you know, can you release this song for me? And it's also about, in that thing, it's like, you know, we don't ignore any of our community. We maintain a relationship with all those people, and we say like, okay, like, you know, this song sounds awesome. We can't sign you right now, but like, here's a bunch of resources. And here's people we could put you in touch with. And like, this song would sound great with this producer that, you know, we are also talking to. So like, you guys should link up. And so it's, it's all based in the relationship. I think if we had launched the label and then totally like turned to cultural to our audience and like turned our channels into promotion for it, it would have been a very different situation. Yeah, definitely.
And so how do those decisions work then, you know, again, knowing you have a limited capacity to sign and support artists and you have this community that you're trying to nurture at the same time, right? So how are those decisions made about who to sign and who not to sign and how's all that work?
So I mean, like from a business perspective, they're kind of two separate businesses. I mean, they're not like, I guess like legally speaking, it's all under the Quadio umbrella, but it you know, who's going to be the artist of the day or who's going to be in one of our show and tells or things like that don't affect necessarily like who we're signing and vice versa. But when it comes to like when we're going to sign an artist, it's usually, you know, we want the whole company to be really excited about their music. We want everyone from, you know, our video designers to, you know, our marketers to me, to our board to be like, wow, this song is awesome. And if it can capture the attention and the interest of that diverse of a group of people with that diverse of a group of tastes, that's really promising. And I think also it's like, it's that combined with, is this artist someone who in our, you know, we have a lot of conversations with any given artist, obviously, before anything even begins to move forward. It's like, is this artist or someone who like really seriously like is like ride or die, like I need to be an artist, is the motivation there. And so it's a combination of a lot of factors about sort of like how those decisions have been made and yeah.
Nice. So what's, I know you said you're relaunching the app. Is that, is that right? So yeah, tell me about what's the future look like? What are you most excited about?
Yeah. So I think one of the big changes is some of the stuff we talked about before, which is going from more than just music to all creatives and wanting all creatives to have a home within the Quadio platform. Which just means like a broadening, like on a base level, broadening the types of content that can be uploaded or posted or shared. But it also, it has a lot of implications about how users can define themselves, how users can find each other. So I think that's a big one. I also think like the other sort of major changes coming are, again, all these are coming from our data and our research and our engagement with the community, but it's the fact that like, a big part of Quadio, the first beta that we had out there was this chart system where as a listener, as a user, you were shown all the music that was coming out of your school. And then you could also look at all the music coming out of your state and all of the music coming out of your region and then all the music nationally. And there, so it was like a chronological feed of all that being uploaded by users broken down by those regions. And there was charts that were sort of like a trending chart within those things. And so the idea was like success within your school. If you're like number 1 through 3 on your school, you should start showing up in like the top 50 in your state. And then so like success within your immediate community would drive you to, you know, a bigger audience and then upwards to like a national level. And that definitely worked in some capacity, but it wasn't where people were spending the most time and getting the most value out of the platform. Looking at our data and talking to our users, the thing that people loved the most and spent the most time on and came back the most for was a page that we didn't really think of as like a big focus for ours, which was this networking page, which was just a list of all the users on the platform. And you could filter by what their skills were and what they were looking for and like what school they went to. And so people just kept coming back for that and using it to find collaborators and using it to find people to give them feedback, people to, you know, sync with all that good stuff. And the charts became one of our like lesser used pages. And so that is all informing how we're rebuilding things and giving people a lot more tools to find their collaborators, giving people a more robust searching system for that. And having that networking aspect as the focus, as opposed to this like competitive streaming aspect as the focus.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, you know, I've done a fair amount of college marketing over the years. And I think, you know, it's definitely tempting to think about the competitive aspect when you think of college experience, right? You have school rivalries, you have teams, you have, you know, it's a competitive environment. And so I think there's that's a really interesting insight to see that that's not where people were naturally driven with this.
Yeah.
Interesting. Cool. I got to get to a little lightning round before I let you get back to work.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, what's your favorite city to travel to?
That's a good question. I don't know if I've traveled to too many cities, like a ton of times. I honestly prefer traveling out of the city and into like the woods, upstate New York.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. That's where my mom lives right now. And I love just getting out into like the wilderness. But I guess like if I had to choose a city, maybe Boston, which is where I grew up. But I haven't been back in like 10 years, but I do love just how much, I loved how old the city is in a way. Like I love the brick and the trees and everything. Yeah.
I haven't been to upstate New York since I was a kid, but I went to a wedding in Connecticut and we stayed, you know, in Manhattan and rented a car, and I was blown away by the fact that like we're driving up West Side Highway and you're into the Bronx and like 10 minutes later you're in the wilderness.
Yeah, it's just like dense woods. Yeah,
crazy, like right outside of the biggest city in the country.
Yeah. I love that.
It was pretty amazing. Yeah, that's cool. Who's your favorite DJ?
Jeez, that's a great question. Maybe DJ Shadow. I don't know. I listened to a lot of Introducing all throughout high school and college, just like constantly. Sure. Yeah.
Shadow. Nice.
Love that.
Yeah. Amazing. He's amazing because he's a great DJ and he can play, you know, I've seen him live a few times and
that's awesome.
Plays sets that are, you know, he can play like a bit more of a traditional DJ set and then go off and do his thing.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Great.
Go for it.
No, please.
I mentioned him earlier, but Nicholas Jaar is another favorite of mine. I saw him play at Music Hall of Williamsburg a couple of years ago, and it was just like an unbelievable show. Yeah.
Cool. Nice. What's the last great book you read or listened to?
I've been reading a lot of poetry lately. I've been making my way through Frank O'Hara's collected poems. I love how conversational his poetry is.
Nice.
Yeah, I think that I also like to read a lot of like graphic novels. It's like Rutu Modan's Exit Wounds was really good. I know it's not like a recent one, but I recently picked that up and finished it very quickly. Yeah.
Cool. What movie do you think you've seen the most in your life?
I would say Pride and Prejudice because it's my wife's favorite movie. And whenever it's like, you know, I think it's like once every couple months, we usually have that on. It's always a good time.
That's so funny. Yeah. It's funny. The answer to that question is always just something random.
Yeah. Outside of that, maybe Happy Gilmore. When I was a kid, I did in like middle school. I didn't have a spring sport. And so I signed up for golf and like, it was like anytime it was raining and we couldn't go to the driving range, the golf coach would just put on Happy Gilmore. So I probably saw it like 15 times. Yeah.
Sure. That's so good. Who's someone you haven't met that you've learned a lot from?
I want to say like a musician, like Justin Vernon, maybe, I think. Listening to Bon Iver's, For Emma Forever Ago in high school taught me a lot about like, I feel just like expression of emotion as an adult man and like what is and isn't, you know, I would say like, guess what is acceptable as opposed to like what isn't. And I think that like a lot of my understanding of like emotionality had been very different prior to listening to someone who was like so open. And I think then listen to a lot of like interviews that he's done and podcasts and stuff that he's been on. Just a really insightful guy and someone whose music I love. Yeah.
That's really interesting. Last one. So if I worked at Quadio, What's something I would hear you say over and over?
That's a good, I think our like internal mantra is like, let's go. And we start and end a lot of our meetings with just like trying to be like high energy, trying to get really excited. Although I would say like the phrase that I tend to say a lot without realizing it is like onwards and upwards, which is just trying to each day, trying to be better than the previous day, or each club that we do, trying to be better than the previous club, or each, you know, everything is, we've got to be improving. That's something we do, like all of our artists, we want every single release to outperform the previous one. And it's just about, up into the right.
Yeah. Fantastic. Right on, man. Well, thanks for doing this with me. It's fun talking to you, and I love what you guys are building. Thanks. Definitely going to be watching, and can't wait to see where you take it next.
I really appreciate that. Thanks so much for having
me. Right on.
You know, that was Marcus Welsh on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Make sure you check out Quadio. Discover some new music bubbling out of college campuses around America. And let's see what else. Come back next week. We got another good one for you coming up. I think it is our 6-year anniversary special, maybe. We'll call it that anyway. So make sure you come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.